everyone, today's episode of Locked On Cavs is a mailbag episode, as well as some additional insight into Cavs Celtics. Kevin Stankiewicz from the Columbus Dispatch is my guest talking through the show. Jared Weiss from The Athletic up in Boston will be the next guest on the show. That will either be up late Friday or early Saturday, depending on when I get around to making it. But I'm going to be talking with him about Cavs Celtics, then back on Sunday. Go on iTunes, leave that 5-star rating interview, and thanks for listening. But here's today's show. And if you have future mailbag questions, lockdowncavs@gmail.com. 5-star review gets a guaranteed answer on your question. But without further ado, here is me and Kevin on the Cavs Celtics and your questions and a whole bunch more.
You are Locked On Cavaliers, your daily podcast on the Cleveland Cavaliers, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Kevin, Rodney Hood had his first public comment since the first report of The Athletic. He refused to go in for game four, 7:30 of the fourth quarter. Fruits going for LeBron James. He says that he didn't mean to be a distraction. They said, and this is what he said. This is from Cleveland.com at practice from Thursday, May 10th. He said, they was like, Hood, that's not really a distraction because of everything they've been through this year. So they took all took a light of it. Hood said they understand, so it wasn't anything really. Hood also said that he saw Jose Calderon was warming up, and when Coach Lou tried to call his name, he said, let Jose play. Now, the original Jason Lloyd reporting, and I'm assuming you read it, and people out there have read it, was much more blunt to the point about this, a little more like, why did Rodney not play? I can empathize with him and understand why he'd be frustrated, but like, what do you make of that explanation that he just let Jose Calderon play and then it's not a big deal?
Yeah, I haven't watched the tape. I haven't seen if Calderon was warming up like he says he was.
I will say this. When I was at the game, the only image of this that I can remember is like looking down and seeing Jose Calderon like getting ready to go in. I didn't even notice that Rodney Hood like was sitting. I thought it was weird that he didn't go in when those guys did, mm-hmm. but I didn't make anything of that other than that Jose Calderon did go in.
Yeah, I think the thing for me is that if Hood is able to find his stroke, he would potentially be a valuable player if he can kind of figure out what has gone so bad for him poorly. So to me, like, the big takeaway is like, why is he not chomping at the bit to get on the floor and try and establish some rhythm? True, it's garbage time, but anytime he can get on the floor and get a shot to fall and perhaps get instill some confidence in him, that to me was the biggest takeaway, was like, that's why I think it was an issue. If his teammates are, if what he said today, if they did laugh, and if they weren't angry and upset as The Athletic reported initially, I mean, I'll take his word for it because I'm not talking to the players, so we'll go with what he's saying. But to me, the reason why I think this matters is if Hood is able to be a solid contributor and help the Cavs bench unit score at the level that they're going to need to score at in these next two potential next two rounds, I think he should be chomping at the bit to get in the game. So that to me is the big takeaway, is that he just was comfortable sitting on the bench. I'll take his word for what the teammates said, and I really don't think it will be a big distraction for LeBron. Like, I don't think that this is keeping LeBron up at night, but you just kind of wonder why Hood is not anticipating or being more excited to get on the floor and hopefully rediscover sort of the kind of play he had contributed sometime earlier this year in Utah.
So let me ask you this. We're in a situation right now where the Cavs are going to face the same team they did last year in the Eastern Conference Finals. But think about where we're at right now. It feels like forever ago that it was February 11th and Clarkson, Hood, and all the other new guys, George Hill, Larry Nance, made their debuts in Boston. In Boston, you had the LeBron celebration, the Jordan Clarkson celebration, them routing Boston. Clarkson in particular had a really big game in that first game. Fast forward to now, months later, in May, this is the list of guys that have been the Cavs' best players so far. It's LeBron, obviously, Kevin Love, George Hill, so the one new guy. But then it's Korver, J.R. Smith, Tristan Thompson, and these old faces. What do you make of the fact that it's not Hood, it's not Clarkson, it's not Nance who's out of the rotation? I mean, is it what is it weird that aside from like Jeff Green, who is hit and miss obviously, and George Hill, that it's just it's the old faces. Like is that kind of weird to you considering that where we're headed?
Yeah, it is a little bit interesting considering that the trade at the deadline was to inject life into the team and bring in new players who can contribute. I don't want to. It's the reason, you know, for Clarkson and Hood to figure out why their games are not, you know, they're not at a level that's like totally playable right now. So it is a little bit weird considering that the trade. And yeah, you mentioned the Boston game and kind of in those first weeks, like Nance has that monster game where he was like 25 and 13 or whatever it was. And so there's a lot of excitement about these guys that they brought in. So it is a little bit weird that most of them are not like have kind of fallen off the rotation right now. But I just make of it like that. I still think obviously, you know, the trade was what they had to do at that time. And of course you'd wish that Clarkson and Hood were at a level right now that they could be part of this rotation. So it is a little bit weird to think about it in that context, but I think the best thing is that Smith and Korver and Love are playing at these high levels right now that even if they were contributing at this level, you probably would have needed to still make a trade. Yes, but Thompson was bad most of the season, and now he's good again. So, like, I'm more excited about that than I'm wondering why Hood is struggling, if that makes sense. So I'd like to see Smith shoot 76% from three in a four-game series. So the level that those players are playing at right now, that high level, makes me less concerned about the fact that these new faces are not really going to be part of the game plan moving forward. But it is a little bit, just stepping back, a little bit strange that the players they brought in are not really doing that much outside of George Hill, who is incredibly important.
Yeah. What are you looking for? We're going to answer some questions after this, but what are you looking for in the Boston series? Like, what to you when you think about this series and you think about what is going to happen and how the team has changed, how Boston has changed since last year, what to you stands out as something that you're interested in seeing?
Yeah, well, it's been brought up before. I'm really interested to see how the tandem of Love and Thompson match up against Horford, who has been excellent this postseason. That to me is something I'm watching for. Can Thompson continue to play kind of like his vintage self? Can Love continue to be the multi-time all-star that he is at? So those two things I'm looking at kind of in the front court section. And then the other big thing is just how aggressive George Hill can be and his impact on the game. I'm pretty sure that Korver's going to continue to be solid, and I, for some reason, am confident in Smith, too. So for me, it's going to be where's George Hill's influence on the game. Obviously, Terry Rozier has been tremendous, and the whole Boston is just really fun to watch for me. I enjoy watching them play a great deal. But so the George Hill piece of this is really where I'm going to be looking at in the backcourt. Is he going to continue to be aggressive offensively? He was in game four. He was great really early on in game four getting to the basket. So I'm going to be watching the level of effectiveness that he has and the aggressiveness on offense, and then defensively how he's able to play on Rozier. I'm assuming he'll be on Smart at times. So I'm really looking at Hill because I think that Korver and Smith have found their game and will continue to be solid. So Hill in the backcourt, and then how if Tristan Thompson and Kevin Love can continue to have Al Horford's number in the frontcourt.
Moving on to questions, we're going to talk more about Al Horford in here, but first question comes from Mike Brooks. He asked a little bit about, what are you hearing about Rodney Hood refusing to sub in late in last night's game? I think everything that is out there is out there, just to clarify this, but to elaborate on what Kevin had said earlier, my thing with this is I think, I talked about this with Eric Gunderson the other day, I think this is just like a weird time for him to be in this type of situation. We don't know yet what the rotation is going to look like. I think there is a role for him to play in the Boston series. I think with him and Jetty, to think about what could come for them. Neither of them is going to be a big piece going forward. I think they could be competing against each other for minutes next year. If you think about what Jetty getting a big role, if he's on the team, assuming like they don't use him in a deal or something, and Hood comes back, like let's say they're both on the team next year, they could do different things. Jetty, I wonder if right now, if game four against Toronto was an indication that he trusts the Jetty going forward and being aggressive, even though there's the offensive limitations. Hood, for all of his flaws, is a much more gifted offensive player at this point. He's got a really nice ability to create his own shot, to get the pull-up. Just not if Jetty offers the exact opposite in a lot of ways. So that to me is just what I want to see what Ty does. And again, I say this all the time about Ty. You are not going to know what he's going to do until he does it
until
in the game.
Does it, right.
You're going to like... I said this before, that the day that Jetty played in game four and then Hood did not play, obviously, he said before the game that he was asked point blank, was it time yet to make the switch to pulling Rodney out of the rotation and playing somebody else? And he asked about the day before, the follow-up question from the media was, okay, it's like, is this now? And he said, no, that time is not yet. Jetty Osman played in the first half of that game. Rodney Hood did not. Ty is going to do it when he does. He's not going to tell us ahead of time. That's just not how he rolls. First one comes from at USB Skates on Twitter. What is the Celtics' biggest advantage in the series and how will the Cavs counter it? Kevin, what do you think Boston's biggest advantage is in the series? If you look at like what Boston can do, that like when you evaluate this team as someone who I know isn't like wasn't watching necessarily like every game is insane all year, but like is thinking about the series as someone coming into it, what are you thinking, okay, Boston could push the Cavs in a different way here? And maybe differently than Toronto. Like, what does Boston do that you're like, I'm interested in this? Like, that excites you about a series that I'll ask you for your pick at the end, I guess, but like, that myself, a lot of people aren't sure is going to be fully competitive.
Right. I think it's just going to be the way that all five pieces at any given time for Boston can be effective in ways that I don't necessarily know is the same for the five players that the Cavs will pull out there. Like, Boston can just do a lot of different things with their lineups, whether it be like Marcus Smart and Rozier in the backcourt with like Brown, Tatum, and Horford. They can just do a lot of different things, and that's why I enjoy watching them play so much, is that it seems like every player they have just brings something new to the table in kind of their own way. So I think that their depth and their ability to do different lineup combinations will be the biggest threat that they pose to the Cavs this year, is that they just have a lot of talent without Hayward and Irving, which is why I find this so impressive too. So that's just going to be really interesting to me, is I don't think that the Cavs necessarily have as many pieces that can contribute. So how Boston uses those pieces interchangeably, I think, is the biggest thing for me in this series, is that there's not really a player that they'll put out there on the floor and you'll kind of like be like, oh, okay, like we don't have to be concerned about this player in some way or another. So that to me is the biggest thing that they can do against the Cavs, just their depth and just how many different pieces they have that they can attack you with.
That is mine as well. I think, you know, I'm very curious to see how the Cavs defend Jaylen Brown. He's obviously a rookie, but he's a very good rookie. JR is probably going to start off on him. What I'm expecting from Boston is going to be a Terry Rozier, Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum, Marcus Morris, Al Horford starting lineup. Yeah,
Brown's the second year. Tatum's the rookie, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And yin and yang in some ways. Like Brown, you know, is more of a defensive player in a vacuum, and Tatum is like this very gifted offensive player. That, like, their ability, Brad Stevens' ability to optimize these lineups to me is sort of like what I find interesting, because the Cavs are going to be in these situations where they have some lineups that have not looked particularly great all the time. So I'll go to NBAstats.com right now. This is a lineup I don't know if we'll see because Nance is out of the rotation. But for example, there's a lineup that's the Cavs' fifth most used lineup or sixth most used lineup. So far in the playoffs, fifth, because I can't count apparently, of Clarkson, Green, Hood, Love, and Nance Jr. Offensive rating 108.4. You're like, okay, that's good. Defensive rating 131.5. That is atrocious. If you look at the sixth most used lineup, which is 13 minutes played, it is Clarkson, Green, Hood, James, and Thompson. That's something I think you have a very good chance of seeing. Offensive rating 87.3, 66.7. Now, I do not think that in this particular series that is something that is going to cost the Cavs a series. It could cost them maybe one game if the Celtics go on a really big run or something, but that's one of Ty's weaknesses as a coach. I think some of his lineup choices are just peculiar. I feel like Brad's pretty well equipped to take advantage of that. And that gets into some of the Cavs' roster limitations and whatnot, but it's not like that's not great. And like this is sort of on the fly adjustments, and it'll be very interesting to see. Like I am of the opinion that Ty is much better when he comes out and has time to game plan. He's, I think, proven that he's a better playoff coach than a regular season coach. He has time to make adjustments. I'm sure he has been, he's had time to game plan for Boston. That they don't play until Sunday, so he had full all Thursday, all Friday, all Saturday to work on and implement game plans, and he's been surely been thinking about this as well as a staff. I'm curious to see what he comes up with and what adjustments he does make.
Yeah, the on-the-fly adjustments, I think, that you kind of just hit at right there, that's like Boston's one of their advantages in the series is that, yeah, they have so much depth and so many different pieces that they can throw out there that if a particular lineup that they that worked well against Philadelphia isn't going so great against the Cavs, they're able to just throw out different combinations and not necessarily lose a ton of productiveness with it. So that I think is just going to be really, really interesting to see how many different combinations and you know, it'll be early on in these, probably, you know, game one and game two, interesting to see like maybe what things that Stevens tries lineup wise that he didn't do against Philadelphia. So those will be some of the things I'm watching because they have the flexibility to do that.
Moving on to the next question, it comes on Twitter from, let me get his ad right, at the Giant of Klee. So first question is these two. Number one, CJ, on the other pod the other day, this is a response to what I talked about with Eric Gunderson about CJ McCollum. Was Kevin Love for CJ silly and I wouldn't do it. I thinking about this more, I tend to agree. I think like you're like I think there's this logic out there that the idea of trading one star to get another star for the Cavs and who they have to beat just doesn't really make a lot of sense. Thoughts? Like, would you? In a vacuum, like CJ might be better right now, more valuable in this NBA. But like, is there a benefit of just like trading one star to get another? That's like, I think there's like some limitations in what you do if you do that.
Yeah, I listened to the pod, and I was really intrigued by that idea. I hadn't thought necessarily of that. I do think that some of the suggestions that you and Eric threw out there. You know, probably involving that first round pick. And so to me, I think that the limitations for the Cavs, at least, is that you'd have to give up, you know, an asset in the first round pick and Love to get another one. It just like they don't have a ton of like wiggle room to play with. If you're another team out there that like if you're Boston, for example, and you're trading one star to get another star, like this is purely hypothetical. Like, if you're like, okay, we're going to trade Kyrie. I know y'all just got him, but, like, they have other assets and more depth that it kind of makes sense. Other young players who are developing and will only improve. For the Cavs right now, it doesn't seem like I would trade one star for another star, so Love for another player, just because of what the rest of the roster looks like to me. That's my general thoughts on it. It's not blanket bad and, you know, not something that you should automatically rule out, but for this Cavs team and the kind of assets that they don't have, I wouldn't necessarily do that.
And then his follow-up question is, why not CJ for the Brooklyn pick, Zizic, Jetty, and Hill? So this is where I come down on this. So the Cavs are in this position where they do not have a ton of assets moving forward. If you look at this cap sheet, Jordan Clarkson's contract is not something other teams are going to want. Rodney Hood, you know, could be like a cheap contract, but he's restricted free agent summer. You have to decide what you do with that. They already owe future first-round picks to the Hawks that are 1 through, I think it's, the way it works is 1 through 10 protected the next two seasons, and if it does not convey those two seasons turns into a second round pick or 2 second round picks, but it's top 10 protected the next two seasons. Basically, if LeBron comes back next season, that pick is going to the Atlanta Hawks the next year. So you're going to be out of first round pick in 2019. It's why if they leave, I think they should just tank and make sure you protect that pick, frankly. This year you don't have your own second round pick this year. Jetty's the first young player they've had and since LeBron's come back that I think is actually worth something. No shade to Kay Felder, just wasn't really an NBA player. And no matter like some of the flashes you showed, Zizic, I mean, obviously struggled early on, looked a lot better, and Cannon looked very good in some of the minutes he got in the second half of the season before he's now relegated to the bench. When you look at a trade for anybody, I think there are certain guys you give up the farm for. I think if the Pelicans call, which they're not going to, and say, hey, if you give us Zizic, Jetty, Kevin Love, and the Brooklyn pick for Anthony Davis, you say yes and you get that trade done. There are other guys of that caliber. I don't believe CJ McCollum is a guy of that caliber. I think, and if you're the Cavs, you're just looking at good asset management. Jetty's your best young prospect as a wing who's 20, just gonna turn 23, just turned 23 years old, already a decent defender, has good instincts, is gonna get better at ball handling, shot creation, 3-point shooting if he keeps developing. It could ultimately be a guy who could defend 4 positions. The Cavs are already asking him to defend 3 positions right now. Zizic is, you know, more of an old school center, but he showed some really good flashes this year. Has a really nice touch around the rim, projects as a good rebounder. There's things to like about his game. The Brooklyn pick. You know, the value of that pick will be decided next week. Trevor Magnotti, who covers the draft, if you're the Sword, will be on this podcast talking about the draft lottery that night. You'll have a pod up right after the game, before game 2. So you can listen to that if that game goes badly, if you just want to listen to the draft stuff because it's fun.
You need an escape.
Yeah, but that 8th pick is, if you look at the ESPN draft tool right now, I'm going to pull that up, but it's a position where the Cavs could, even if it's a lottery pick, and lottery picks are really valuable, it's for the Cavs. You don't know exactly what you're getting. It's no guarantee that a guy in the 8th pick of the draft is going to be any good. Every data point you can look at tells you that the later you get in the lottery, the less valuable those picks get. But if you look at right now, doing that like a mock, if the Cavs end up picking 8th or 9th, you know, Miles Bridges might be a really good player. But what is his real value? Mikal Bridges from Villanova is also in that class. Michael Porter Jr., Wendell Carter, Bamba. These are Trey Young, theoretically, are some of these guys in there. These guys, if you get up to number 1 and it's Doncic, Ayton, Jaren Jackson, Marvin Bagley, someone like that, maybe, and particularly Doncic and Ayton, maybe that pick, that value is particularly higher for some team. Like maybe the Thunder, if they want Paul George, maybe that player, that pick becomes more valuable. But if it's 8, you just don't know exactly how valuable it is. That being said, it's something the value on that is ticking. It's something if you're going to do it now. But I think if you're giving up all of that in one trade, it better be, if you're giving up all your assets in one trade, include and George Hill, who's a good point guard. And yes, like you're getting McCollum, but there's something you're giving up and giving up Hill to some degree. And he's also a tradable contract because he has that $1 million guarantee on the next part of his deal. This is a long-winded way of saying, for me personally, that's a hill too far. If you're going to like trade for CJ McCollum, who I think is really good, would be a really good fit with LeBron, all these things, I think that is like, even if it gives you McCollum, Love, and LeBron, that's just like all of your best young assets. You immediately get old again, and it's not.
Yeah, you would have to have an incredible next step once you acquire McCollum. Like, you have to think way out beyond that trade.
Let's say this. If the Cavs did that, let's say, like, they do that, the roster next year, you would be bringing back Tristan Thompson, obviously, Kevin Love, LeBron James. You're re-signing Rodney Hood at that point because you need guard depth.
And he's restricted.
So you bring him back.
Yeah.
You're probably bringing back Jeff. I mean, you're bringing. I think Jeff Green's going to be on the team next year, regardless. But, you know, you're probably filling out the roster with that. Like, that's your core JR. It's the same guys you have this year, and then banking more on Rodney Hood.
Korver a year older
Korver a year older. Is he get the 2 years in a row with a foot injury? Like, I get why you like go all in, but I don't know if this, no shade on CJ. I just don't know if he's the guy I give up all my young. All three of the very few young assets you have in one deal for one guy that, like, if they get CJ McCollum, does he make them better? Yeah, like, I think he probably makes them better. Does he make you a favorite against the Warriors? No. You know, I'm not sure anyone they do does, but, like, Paul George, like, might make more sense.
Yeah, no, and I'd agree with that. That would just kind of be my general take with that is that McCollum, well, I like him and he likes the Browns, which is great. Just not willing to part with basically the only assets the Cavs have. It would have to really be that Anthony Davis player, which, again, is, we're only using as an example on this podcast, not a real thing. But that's where I think you stand when trading for a big star like that.
Next question comes from Corey Kranick via email. By the way, those CJ McCollum questions, not going to go away until next week. And I expect there to be a lot of chatter. Just throw it out there. No, he has a couple questions. Number one, does Larry Nance have a place in the Boston series? If Tristan gets in foul trouble, he absolutely is going to have to. He's going to have to match Baines if Tristan gets in foul trouble. A lot of it will, in my opinion, depend on what kind of lineup Boston uses. Do we see Horford and Baines together? If so, I think there's a better chance of seeing Nance than if they're playing Horford at the 5. Do you think, I mean, Kevin, do you think Nance, like, do you think it's weird? I mean, does it matter to you, like, that Nance is, like, do you think it, like, matters, really? Because I don't think it does, because I think him and Tristan just kind of do a lot of the same stuff, and Tristan has just been better.
Yeah, no, exactly. They're really similar players, and that's exactly, like, if Tristan gets in foul trouble and Nance has to come into the game with, like, let's say Tristan's got two on him and at the 5-minute mark in the first quarter or something like that. Like, I certainly wouldn't be cringing if I see Nance take off his warm-ups. So I think he has a place in this series in those instances. And I don't know. I'm not, like, terrified of that thought that he might have to play a little bit. I certainly could envision that, again, if Tristan gets in foul trouble. I mean, Horford going up against, that's going to take a lot of energy and a lot of activity. So it's very possible that Tristan could just get in foul trouble or be worn down, or Horford could have some success on him and Lou might say, okay, let's get a little bit, you know, just a fresh body in there on Horford. So I think it's possible that he has a place in the series, and ideally he would play better than he has. But I do think there's potentially a place for him. I don't think you're necessarily going to insert him to any lineups right away, but in response to some changes or some things that happen in the game, I think you could certainly envision a scenario that he's in there.
Would you rather see him or do you think it's more likely we see him or Hood return to the rotation?
With the wing depth that Boston has, probably Hood.
I think it's Hood, and I think it's pretty. Yeah, I think it's Hood. I think just the scoring too, just the shot creation. I think, like,
because Boston can score with so many different pieces that I think that, like, you're gonna need you if some of your other offensive players, if Smith's struggling or something like that, you're gonna have to turn to a player that can potentially create more offense, and that's Hood.
I almost wonder. This is my thing with Hood and him playing. I think there's a world where you, like, Ty keeps talking about how he wants Rodney to be more aggressive. I think there's a situation where you could put him in as your lead, not a lead guard. I don't know exactly how this works. It might have to be with LeBron and bench units, but, like, if Jordan Clarkson, Boston's really long, right? They're gonna play Brown, Tatum, Ojale. They're gonna be, like, fairly long on the wing, and they're gonna be longer next year. Like, even right now, they're kind of long. You might be, and Clarkson. I don't think Jordan Clarkson's a good defender, not a good distributor. I almost wonder if you're better off just playing Hood. Like, the lineup could be this could get really cramped, but if it's, like, let's say the possible lineup would be Hood, Osman on the floor together, LeBron, Jeff Green, Tristan or Love, or some version of, like, where maybe there's a, like, Korver's on the floor and LeBron's playing the five. Like, there's some version out there, I think, where you could go really long and Hood gets Clarkson's minutes and you still play Jetty, because I'm in on playing Jetty. But
I think for, like, particularly in this series with, like, just with Brown and Tatum and their length that and their activity on offense, again, Brown is better on defense, but he's uber athletic. In the past, in the Philly series, made some really good plays going to the basket. I think Osman for sure has a role playing.
He at least has, like, a better shot than Clarkson. And, like, you know, Marcus, like, look at Marcus Smart, who came back, was a big difference for them in Milwaukee, was very good against Philly. The stronger guy is going to get inside, post up. That's not good for Clarkson. I'm not saying Osman's, like, totally ready for that yet. I think he's, like, not strong enough for some of that yet, but I think, like, I would rather just see him give it a shot and Hood give it a shot, even though Hood's, like, not particularly strong either. How does Boston guard the Cavs? And in particular, who does Horford guard? And who tries to guard LeBron? So I think this is what you'll see in Boston. Marcus Smart is going to guard LeBron. Jaylen Brown is going to guard LeBron. Al Horford is going to guard LeBron James. I think all three of those guys do. Marcus Smart might have the best chance, frankly. Who do you think has the best shot of, like trying to stop LeBron? Like, who the battle interests you the most? I think it's Marcus, just because he's, like, maybe the strongest of those. Not stronger than Allen necessarily, but he's just, like, going to make it really – he's going to be, like, Lancey annoying when LeBron posts up. And LeBron is feasted in the post this whole playoff.
Yeah, I like that matchup when Smart's guarding LeBron. It's just fun to watch.
Like Lance, but, like, better. Because
Smart is
better. And, like, yeah, Lance, like, exactly. Lance in that series, you could, like, watch him, like, get, like, in LeBron's face. But you could see him, like, taking these, like, huge dropbacks to take the brunt of the force, which you have to do because LeBron's this, like, mammoth of, like, a human being. But it's, like, you saw him take several feet of space, and then LeBron would bump into him, and then he'd initiate contact. I think Marcus is going to try to, like, be smart about it, but he's going to, like, be more physical from the get-go with LeBron.
Yeah, no, I'm really interested in that matchup. And I remember Brown on LeBron a little bit last year
He did as well as a rookie as you could
have asked. Yeah, right, exactly. So I think I'm definitely more interested in Smart just because I like his game too. But it will be interesting to see, you know, how Brown plays him because, again, I'm a big fan of Brown's game. I really like watching him play. So I think that both of those, the Horford one certainly doesn't excite me in any, like, it's just not a really a particularly fun matchup. But Smart and Brown, I think, are two really good defensive pieces for Boston to throw at him. And, of course, they will probably be number one and two in terms of the assignments on LeBron.
Boston guards the rest of the Cavs. This is the starting, let's say the starting lineup is the Terry Rozier, Jalen, Jason Tatum, Marcus Morris, Al Horford. I would say you go Hill is gonna get Rozier. I think that's pretty obvious. And let's say it's for the Cavs, Korver, Smith, LeBron, Hill, Love. Korver, I think, goes on Jalen. And I think the Cavs are good with that. I think, like, Jalen, at this point, you're probably okay if he tries to attack you in isolation. Like, I think you're good with that. I think JR starting on Jason Tatum.
Yeah, I think so.
They had him guard KD before. I mean, good luck to JR because, like, Tatum's really good. And like, there's a big height disadvantage there. But I think that's what you're going to see to start off games. LeBron's going to be on Marcus Morris. I think they're going to trap. And I think you're going to see the same trapping we've seen. And then LeBron, that leaves Kevin Love on Al Horford. And I think the other way, I think you're going to see Rozier is going to guard Hill. I think you're going to have Brown. I think you might have, if Marcus Smart, maybe Marcus Smart starts. And like, maybe that happens as well. And that's another hiding place for Korver, theoretically. Because I think you're going to try to hide Korver. And LeBron is going to be whoever can play free safety. I think that's basically like the theme of this. I think Brown, like if it's the Marcus Morris lineup, I think you would see Jalen start on LeBron. And if not, I think it's Smart. If Marcus Smart starts with Rozier, I think it's Marcus Smart starts on LeBron. And in that case, Rozier still guards Hill. Jalen's probably guarding JR.
Yeah.
Tatum's going to guard Korver. And then Horford's guarding Love. I think Horford guarding Love is like the one universal. Think about this. But if it's Marcus Morris, I think Marcus Morris could probably get some time on LeBron too. But I think in that case, it would be... That's like true. As I think about this, I think it's probably Marcus Smart starting just because if it's the other way around... It's Horford on Love, obviously. Rozier on Hill. Brown, if you put Brown on LeBron, that means one of Tatum or Morris has to chase around JR or Korver.
Yeah, and I'm thinking, if you're Boston, you don't want Korver or Smith to get going early.
And like
you want to make it as hard as you can for them as soon as possible. And so, like, if you can create a lineup that you can have the very active Jalen Brown on the very active JR Smith.
The length to crowd him as a shooter,
yeah, exactly.
Or like maybe even on Korver because like you want him tracking. Like Kyle Lowry is a very good defender. If you go back and watch Korver's buckets, especially in Game 4, he was shredding Lowry on cuts.
Oh yeah, those were fun. And Zach Lowe had a great piece. Yeah. I would like to call that out on ESPN.com.
If you go in the show notes, I'm gonna put that there. People can go should go read that. It's a really good piece. And look at how Kevin Love and Kyle Korver have been really good to the offense. But I think I would
just talking about it now. I would anticipate Smart. I think in the lineup, because Morris didn't play particularly well in Game 5 either. I can't remember what he finished with, but I think he was like at some point like missed his first four or five shots and just didn't necessarily play as well as he could have in that game, at least in the early going. So I think that it's most likely that you would see Smart. Just because of the flexibility that you get at the other four spots, or other three spots, I guess I would say that Love and Horford are matched up no matter what. But
yeah, I think you're right. And I think that when I think about this, I think Marcus Smart makes more sense for Boston. I think starting Morris creates like some just problems for them. And that just seems like not intuitive if they're not going
to. Exactly. Like he'll play, but why put him in the starting lineup like if it's going to be more create problems for how
especially with how the Cavs have played so far and have been so reliant on offense, and if like the gap if their path to victory is like muck this up, be really good on defense, be really smart. No pun intended. I mean pun unintentionally intended. you're gonna have to do like make all these smart lineup decisions, and that would seem to be the more logical one as we think about this. Kevin, we'll wrap it up on this. Game 1 starts this Sunday, so we have some time. But right now, as you think about the series, who's the Cavs are like 70% favorites over Boston. Do they make the four straight finals? Is this a four straight finals appearance for LeBron, Kevin Love, and company?
I do think it is. I'm right now, like, the whole shit I've been thinking, like, my mind's been jumping what my prediction would be. It's not going to go seven. I don't know if it would be I think right now I'm most comfortable with Cavs in six. I do think that Boston is just a really, really, I mean, they're so young in a lot of ways that we really don't know, like, what kind of strides that they could even make from, like, a series to series. They're just continuing to get better. Tatum's continuing to get better. So I like Boston being able to win a game or two. I don't think it'll go seven, but I also don't know if it will just be the Cavs only drop one of them. So I like if it in Cavs in six, just conservatively. But I do think the Cavs will be back in the finals, and I hope that to continue to see them playing at the level that they were at. Like, LeBron is probably going to be a superhuman again, and if you're able to get All-Star Kevin Love and the kind of contributions that Korver and Smith put forth in the Toronto series, I think the Cavs are in as good of shape as they can be going into a fourth straight finals appearance.
I think they get there as well. I'm leading five. I think LeBron is going to – he's been so good. I think he's going to continue to be really good. I do like the argument. I'll put the Ringer piece from Jonathan Charks in the show notes as well that people should read. But I do think there's some of the idea that Boston can – create some sort of, like, they're going to be better equipped to defend some of this. Like, it's not CJ Miles and DeMar DeRozan and those guys chasing around. Like, no shade to them, but, like, it's just these guys are going to be smarter defenders, and they've been athletically they're going to be a little bit better. I'm very curious to see how the Cavs defend Tatum. I think that's interesting, but I do think the Cavs win. I think in five is my prediction. I think five or six is as far as it goes. I think I'd be surprised if it goes seven. I wouldn't be surprised by a sweep either. I think, like, just a series where the Cavs, like, win four really close games. I think that's totally possible, but it's going to be interesting. Kevin, just let everyone know where they can find you on the worst app / website in the world.
Yeah, you can find me on the twitter.com at Kevin_Stank, STANK. You can follow some of my work that will be forthcoming from the Columbus Dispatch this summer. So,
yeah, get the Columbus Dispatch. It's a good Ohio newspaper.
Gotta support local journalism.
Yeah, support local journalism. Read the Dispatch. Read Kevin's work. And we'll be back tomorrow. Jared Weiss, if you're listening to this on Friday, that pod with Jared Weiss is either going up late Friday or early Saturday, depending on when I get around to editing it. But you can check that out on the same feed. Listen to that show. Game one is Sunday. After that Jared pod, the pod will be back after the game on Sunday. And then we'll have, like, a reaction, an extended reaction, probably recorded on Facebook Live Sunday night after the traditional recap. But find me on Twitter at @CDimmRights, pod on Twitter and Facebook at @LockedOnCavs. Go on iTunes, leave that 5-star rating and review. If you leave a 5-star rating and review and then send the picture of that review in with your questions, guaranteed to get them answered on the show. I'm not above bribing. And we'll be back. Check out FruitTheSword.com. A whole bunch of stuff coming there as well. Cheers, y'all.